I think maybe we should start. I know you should be, if you've been listening this week, you should be very exhausted. So we'll try not to torture you more than we'll have to. So I'll try to make this brief and, painless. although... well, first, I need to say that it said on the sheet, Dr. Bjørn Hinderaker. I'm very happy to be that you confer doctorates here, but I'm not a doctor. I'm not the son of a doctor, but I need you to be patient with me, right? So, but I'm a reverend. I'm a pastor in Kristiansand in Norway, and also lecturer at Gimlekollen School of Journalism and Communication. I teach ethics worldview for Christian and secular journalists. And we have also this special communication worldview course, which is the thing that's closest. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. With Dr. Bjorn, I guess. Mm-hmm. I presume, isn't that what we say? Yeah. I've been very interested in apologetics for 20, 25 years now, I think. I think it's very encouraging to see the same interest in Europe. So it's very encouraging for me to come here, because sometimes we could feel very lonely back home, because high church, low church, charismatic, conservative, all of them are negative to apologetics. Skeptical to the use of reason, and they will have to apply other means. So I really hope for a revival in terms of apologetics. My interest in New Begin came in the UK. I was studying or reading with the Whitfield Institute, with Dr. David Cook. Some of you would know him. I read several kind of different things with him, but New Begin was one of the things I really got interested in. And well, I've had the interest since then, but I haven't read very much since then. So I read then, I have the material, I've read some now, and what I'm going to do, I want to present the position of New Begin and help us start making a good appraisal and critique of him. He's a very significant theologian. Some people put him on line with Barth, the second half of the 20th century. He's one of the most significant thinkers, Christian thinkers, as some people say. He's also called here on one of the books by David Bosch. Leslie New Begin is one of the ablest Christian apologists of our time, which certainly justifies us here at the conference taking up his name and his ideas. He has a very original way of taking the challenge of mission to the West. He was a missionary to India, returned to the UK, and saw a very different scene from what he had left. And then he used his missionary experience, his missionary understanding, to analyze the situation. That's very, very helpful. That's one of the main contributions. Looking at the challenge of the mission to the West, not mission to overseas, to other, but mission to the West. The second thing is, of course, well, not of course, but the way he writes gives you a new confidence in the gospel. And I really think very many people have experienced that, and that's why he's so very popular with evangelicals, especially. He also has Catholic followers and liberal. But he gives a new confidence in the gospel. However, we have to question if the confidence he gives, is it the right kind of confidence? Is it the proper confidence, which is the name of one of his books, of course. So very many evangelicals have read him. I would guess some of you have come across him since you've come here. I guess it might not have been my name which pulled you in here. Probably the first time you come across my name. But Leslie Newbegin is widely read. He is very fascinating. One of the problems with him, as with some other very important names, is that his images, his way of using words, is so strong, stronger than the content of it. His words carry kind of more strength in the way he uses the imagery than in the content. That's why it's very important for us to go down, look at the content critically. And I am quite sure that we'll have to look critically at it. I'll explain later why. Okay, Mission, Postmodernity, and Apologetics. You've got a handout. I'll try to make some notes so you don't have to write too much. I think I need to say a little bit about his biography, his life. He was born in 1909. He was one of the Oxbridge kind of scholars, the pre-war scholars, studied in Cambridge. He was actually an agnostic when he started studying, and he was once challenged, "Do you believe in God?" As he didn't know the answer to the question, he started reading the Bible. And he started reading the Bible half an hour every morning before breakfast, from that point on, throughout the rest of his life, being an agnostic, right? And then he was very idealistic. He joined, his conversion goes like this. He joined a camp for unemployed miners. And at that camp, the people drank and they fought, and his idealism kind of broke up or crushed. And that night, he says in his autobiography, An Unfinished Agenda, he had a vision. He had a vision of a cross spanning the space between heaven and earth. And said, from that day, I was sure that there was only the cross could make sense of the world, the mess of the world. So that's his experience. And I think if you have that, his experience in the back of your mind, it will explain something about his understanding of what faith is and how people come to faith. Well, he got involved in student Christian... No. SCM. Student Christian Mission? Movement, of course. Sorry. I'm not English, so I have the excuse. And he became a missionary to India. He became a bishop there in two periods. He was in India. In between there, he was very much involved with the World Council of Churches, important matters looking at mission and evangelism, especially. What is significant, especially for us, is the period from 1974 when he retired from India and he took the bus from India, returning back to Europe. And he read Karl Barth's Church Dogmatics on his way. That's not kind of the mm-hmm. Okay. After that time, he meeting with the UK setting, he was shocked to find all the changes since he left the England, and he was struggling to use his missionary experience to understand these challenges. He says that the resistance to the gospel was a lot stronger in the English context than he had experienced in India. And that had changed for that period of 30, 40, 50 years. He was also a pastor without pay from 1979, where they were planned to shut down a church. And he said, no, we can't do that. This is the mission of the church. And they said, okay, if you would be a pastor here, and we can't pay you. And that's quite a special person, quite a special pastor. So he was practicing as a pastor as well in the UK. He got involved in several different things, and after some time, he was involved in British Council of Churches, preparing for a conference. He wrote a paper. He was not happy at all with the things they were doing. They were talking about social injustice and so on. And he wrote a paper, The Other Side of 1984, which kind of is the start of these issues which we are dealing with right now, which also started the Gospel in Our Culture movement, which is alive even today. Significant movement which tries to link the gospel with our culture in a intelligent way. Okay, let's turn to his diagnosis of the postmodern West. One of the questions he asked or was asked early in the 70s, he heard the comment, "Can the West be saved? The challenge is so great. We see the numbers of the churches go down, and the resistance to the gospel increasing. So can the West be saved?" It's kind of a starting point. One of the characteristics used for modern society, or if you call postmodern society, he's more concerned with modernity, thinking that postmodernity is really just a collapse of modernity or implosion of modernity, he says. One of the more main characteristics is the pluralist society. Here, new begin, the gospel in a pluralist society. From being a kind of Christian nation, a Christian culture, we now have plural, we have many alternatives. So everything is, it's up to each one to choose religion, to choose their ethics. What he points out is that this relativism, which had come in England, is valid only on one level, on the level of values. So that's where he starts, where there is pluralism and relativism in terms of religion and values. Everyone has to choose their own position, their own values, their own religions. But when you get into a physics class, there is no relativism. So there are two areas. The West thinks in has a divided view of reality. One part of reality belongs to, or knowledge, belongs to the fact area. You can see that that's on the bottom. That's objective facts. You can't doubt them. And then on the top, you have values. That's a different area of knowledge, which is entirely subjective and relative. You have to choose. You're Christian, you're a Buddhist, or you're a Muslim. Well, that's your own decision. That's, of course, your subjective opinion, choosing values. Okay, his analysis of this. His starting point is that this division in facts and values, and in the public, the area of facts are public matters, and the area of values and faith and religion belongs to the value and subjective and private area. It seems to give us a lot of freedom. But he really thinks this is a captivity, a kind of a new kind of Babylonian captivity of the church in the West, and it has fallen captive. It doesn't even know it is captive. It's kind of it's peace. We can live in peace because it's all subjective value judgments. His analysis of the post-Enlightenment culture goes like this. It's a kind of a short summary. You'll find that in this book, World in Season. His main ideas well, his concept is repeated in all these books. So the main, his main idea is, point one is Western mindset. The Western plausibility structure is a divided understanding of knowledge. Division of facts and values. We think in two different areas. You don't go to church to get to know things. You go to church to have values. You don't expect to hear facts in the church. And you're not supposed to bring values into physics and science because that's making it subjective. This fact-value dichotomy has roots, he says, in Enlightenment thinking. He's linking to Alistair McIntyre's, who's pointing out that during the Enlightenment, they changed the perspective from looking at purpose. You know, in the Aristotelian universe, everything had their meaning from their purpose, their ultimate aim. That was kind of a definition of a thing. The new science grew from changing the perspective, not asking for what is the purpose of something, but what is its cause, looking for a cause. That's, he calls, loss of teleology, losing the perspective of purpose, which really paved the way for empirical science, of course. And then he says this causes ethics to just hang up in the air, because if you have ethics is based on a difference between what is and what ought to be, and for modern man we do not have a vision of what ought to be, but the old vision of reality was that everything had a goal, even humanity or human beings had a goal or a purpose, which the ethics could put the ethics in place. This loss of teleology made ethics kind of fall out of the area of science and knowledge, and also, of course, the ultimate purpose. You cannot find the ultimate purpose of a thing, for example, a watch, by just analyzing its individual parts. You cannot. That's just the point that John Lennox brought up. One of the first. That was on Apologetics Network, I think. If you get a cake, and you ask to analyze it, you can analyze it into chemicals or ingredients or whatever, but you cannot find the purpose of the cake. Then you have to ask my mother who made it. It's for Bjorn, my special son who has a birthday, right? But to know the purpose of this thing, need to get into the mind of the maker. You cannot find the purpose by looking at the thing and analyzing, putting things apart. So the loss of teleology has to mean that you cannot find the purpose of the universe. So this leaves the area of purpose, ultimate purpose, and even ethics to the area of subjectivity, because everything regarding knowledge was focusing on cause, not purpose. Okay, and he comes over to Descartes, who widened the split, he says, by his ideal of certain, indubitable knowledge. He says, knowledge needs to be absolutely certain. And we need to put away everything that's not absolutely certain. And he made the system of doubt his method, and he made mathematics the kind of thing that built this whole thing up. So the idea of knowledge is absolutely certain knowledge made out from certain basics and then built up by mathematics. If this is the idea of knowledge, very, very much will, of course, fall on the side of this. Of course, he was very... it was very important for Descartes and the people of that time to just get loose from the old authorities and so on. And that was an attempt to build a new basis for knowledge and understanding. And he says, well, the consequence here is, of course, the first casualty is the Bible. Because that kind of knowledge is not that kind of knowledge which is based on eternal truths and which cannot be doubted and built up like a mathematical system. Okay, that's his view or his description of the Enlightenment culture, the modern mindset, roots in the Enlightenment, following the ideal of Descartes for certain scientific knowledge. And the Bible and religion is falling on the side as something subjective, something which is not proper knowledge. Well, his suggestion for remedy here is really significant. Well, he starts with a new epistemology. He says the whole issue is really a question of epistemology, a question of what, how can we know? One of the Descartes is kind of the person who is responsible for the fall in his sight. There is a kind of a new fall when human beings try to gain certain knowledge without God. So he, it's about knowledge, he says. And he starts from Augustine, at least he said so, credo ut intellegam, I believe in order to understand. He says, faith precedes knowledge. You don't need to understand before you believe. Faith is the starting point. Faith provides the real starting point for seeing the world. And he links up with Peter Berger, who talks about plausibility structures. He says every society, every culture has idea of what is plausible, what counts as real. And inside of this culture, everything, language, reason, ethics, belong. And everything links to this plausibility structure. So every kind of reason operates inside a plausibility structure. There's no neutral, there cannot be a neutral kind of reason. There's only reason within plausibility structures, he says. Or in cultures, you could also say. And truth is perspectival. Truth is something which gives you a perspective on everything else. And he also says that, of course, if reason and thinking always belongs inside a structure, a thinking structure, there cannot be objective criteria. They belong inside structures all the time. And then he uses Michael Polanyi, an important scientist who threw himself into philosophy of science because he saw lots of problems with the modern idea of science as the truth and indubitable truth and so on.
What's the name of
that book? Personal knowledge. Personal knowledge. He says that science is really not, science is not undoubtable. It's not indubitable. You can doubt it, and it's always depending on something else. He says knowledge is always personal. It demands a commitment. It presupposes a lot of assumptions, questions. And he talks about tacit knowledge. There is a kind of a knowledge which we have not put in words, and maybe we cannot put it in words, but which is there, and which guides our questions and understanding. He turns from, he says, the visual view of truth is insufficient. We need to add the tactual view of truth. seeing truth not just as something to look at, but something we look through as glasses, or as a tool. Just like the surgeon, when he operates, he uses lots of tools, but he doesn't focus on the tools when he's working. He is applying the tools when he has learned to use them, and he's focusing on the task. That is kind of tacit knowledge. You have something built into your understanding, which is there. So knowledge is not the objective, formal, neutral kind of activity which modern people have understood it to be. That is Polanyi, and I think Polanyi is one of the most important basics for his thinking. And I think Michael Polanyi has a lot to teach us anyway. The second suggestion for a remedy is, he says, is turning, these things belong together, turning to the Bible as a story. We shouldn't look at the Bible as a thing, as truth which we can analyze, and as a piece of meat to cut it up and eat it or throw it away. The Bible should be viewed as a story. And then he links to George Lindbeck, which is a significant thinker, using the cultural linguistic model of doctrine. Doctrine is not about, it is not about eternal truths. It's rather about giving perspectives. It's like putting on glasses. And he says, we should look at the Bible as a narrative, Bible as a story, not as information. And the Bible comes to us not as just information, but as a person who is calling on us. You know, remember his experience of conversion. The story is grabbing you and pulling you in a direction. It's not something you sit over and analyze. It comes at you. It invades you. And one of the important thing is that this story of the Bible gives you a new starting point. Barth had this illustration that God doesn't come to us like an aeroplane sailing down gently and fitting very well into our hearts or our lives. It's rather like a bomb. He's dropping down like a bomb and destroying everything else so that something new can be built up. He's really looking very much like Barth here, that the gospel, the story of the Bible, not the information, but the story of the Bible is such a radical new starting point. It changes everything else. It gives a new plausibility structure by itself. And the Christian shouldn't read the Bible as information and put it up on a list of what is true and not true, but read it as a dramatic story, and we should indwell it, we should go into it, we should make it our own story, and we should use this story to look at the world. This story are our glasses that give us the meaning and purpose of our whole life and the whole universe, of course. Not at all. But we shouldn't. That shouldn't be our focus. Yeah, yeah. But that's a soft toe or whatever, soft spot here in his. We'll get back to that. And he tries to get away from the charge of relativism here, because he says that reason is always dependent on your perspective. And he says, well, the story of the Bible is a story, and you can't use anything else to justify it. It justifies itself, he says. But how does it? How can he get away from relativism and says, well, this is not relativism, firstly, because it has to do with personal commitment and responsibility. It's not something you say lightly, this is my view and that's your view, but you are committed to the view, which makes it not the normal kind of relativism, at least. And then he says that it's this perspective of the Bible, or biblical story, has a universal intent. There is an intention here that this is the true story for every human being, which means that we must publish it and allow other people to test it, right? But we have no means outside the story to test it. But we share it. And that's one of his very exciting points, that he says that, well, the point of this story is that we must make it public, and that is mission work, which is the exegesis of the gospel, he says. And that's the way the gospel is meant to be understood. Okay. And the third point here is the church as indwelling and living the story. Jesus never wrote anything apart from writing in the sand, but he says, and contrasting us with Muslims who have the Quran, which is the divine word, I'm not sure he would say it's idolatry, but the way God revealed himself to us was a life of Jesus given to the apostle, to the Christian community, the story given to the Christian community. And the Christian community is to live that story, is to carry it forward and proclaim that story. Okay. That is his remedy, a new epistemology, the Bible as a story, and the church as a focus. The church, the community as the focus, who carries this story and itself living the story. There are two kind of consequences here which are very significant and serious. The first one is, of course, that the result of this is that you can only, in terms of apologetics, you can only proclaim. You cannot use reason to defend or giving a neutral point, basis for arguing for the Christian position. Because all reason operates within plausibility structures. He says, we have no way in which we can demonstrate the truth of that claim by reference to some supposedly more ultimate realities. The story of the Bible is the ultimate reality. And we shouldn't look for more ultimate reality than this, because that would be idolatry or reverting to something less than the ultimate story. And the second issue is scripture, which really makes one worried about people taking In New Begin without critical reflection. Because this view of the scripture is very interesting and enlightening in one way, but the way of reducing the Bible to only narrative, to only story, is problematic, of course, as your point was, because not all of the Bible is story. We have the letter to the Romans, which is not a story, but of course it's based on the story, the universal story of God, the Creator, the Savior, and so on. He thinks by giving us a new epistemology, he wants to bridge the gap between liberals and conservatives, because both of them have gone into the trap of enlightenment ideas. Because the liberals think that religion is subjective experience. And by saying that, he says it's clearly exactly what modernity or what enlightenment says. And the same with what he called fundamentalists. you know, the categories here. He uses the word fundamentalists, who looks at the Bible as inerrant truths. He says, well, that's not biblical. You cannot think of the Bible as inerrant, because the Bible is a story. And secondly, the Bible is given to people in history, but to fallible people. And they can have made mistakes all the way from receiving revelation, telling the story, writing it down, preserving it, making the canon, and so on. So it cannot be seen as a fallible, infallible truth. He says they have also, the fundamentalists have also fallen into the trap of Descartes, looking for something we cannot doubt. And you're making this an absolute, certain, indubitable basis to build your system on. I'll give you some quotes from him. Of course, he says that Jesus gave us a community of believers, not a book. If maybe you've gotten a slightly different perspective if you'd asked Paul and Peter, but okay, his point is taken. He says, at every point, human judgment and human fallibility are involved. The idea that at a certain point in this long history, a line is drawn before which everything is divine word and after which everything is human judgment is absurd, he said. It's absurd to think that the Bible has an absolute authority. And he says, well, the launching of the Christian story into the life of the classical world of antiquity eventually required a whole new starting point for thought. Yes. This is his remedy. Let's go to some appraisal and critique. Maybe I should do this quite briefly. I'd like to focus perhaps on the third point. In terms of cultural analysis, I think he's got some really significant things to give us. Of course, the need for an analysis. If we live in and imbibe a culture, maybe it's even more that we important for us to examine this culture we live in. As fish, we do not understand the water we live in. It's even more pressing for us to analyze and understand this culture, to see how we ourselves are captive to it. And he points out that it's post-Christian. We cannot preach and teach and evangelize as if these people believed in the Bible, believed in God and Christ, or anything. We have to start not just from the beginning, but we need, since it's a post-Christian culture, it's not the pre-Christian culture. It's post-Christian culture which is immune from influence from Christianity, because they think they have tried it. We have tried Christianity and we see what it is. It's post-Christian, the post-Christian challenge. Of course, the influence of the Enlightenment of ideas on knowledge is significant. I think we need to take that into consideration as well. In terms of critique of this point, I think the roots of the Enlightenment, we need to widen that a little bit. Vinod Ramachandra, this book here, is a very good book on mission. It deals with, among others, Leslie Newbegin. Vinod Ramachandra, he's from Sri Lanka. With the IFES, he is very well read, and he points out that the view of what enlightenment was needs to be given a little more depth. But basically, he says that he has some Newbegin has some significant points, but it's not just the ideas of knowledge which is important, which has changed Europe, but also Luther's distinctions about the two kingdoms, right? You have the secular and you have the kingdom of the gospel, the spiritual realm, right? Which functioned as a secularizer eventually. And also the religious wars, which really created a doubt and disillusionment with traditional authorities. Not just the quest for certain knowledge, but the disillusionment with authority. And he says that he points out that the main point of the Enlightenment was not the quest for certain knowledge, but it was new pagan ideas coming up. He calls it a neo-stoicism, which was really not a question of knowledge, but an even more basic question of the will. And you see this is maybe even a deeper question under Enlightenment. It's not just a question, can we know God, but the question of the human will, which is making itself against God, perhaps.
Excuse me, yeah. Would you say that he saw the Enlightenment, to some degree, a revival of neo-pagan ideas?
Yes, Vinod Ramachandra, yeah. So it's not just the philosophical search for knowledge, but he says here there are some tendency. It's re-pagan, which really makes this a deeper problem than just knowledge. It's going to the kind of a worshiping or encouraging the will of the individual, which might be a deeper issue than just knowledge as well. But of course, and the second question is his critique of the fact and value distinction. Maybe it's a little too sweeping. Maybe not everything in our society follows that distinction as much as he seems to point out. And maybe he's too negative to it, because there is some sense in which this distinction could be seen to be valid. Or let me just run through the church here. The vision for the church of the Bible story, the challenge of mission, the challenge of being a new social order, is all very important very helpful. That the truth of the gospel is not just some proposition you put up, because that's very often the idea we have in traditional conservative groups and churches, as my own. We want to formulate us in doctrinal ways, but the Bible is also, and maybe even in some ways, in a more fundamental way, a story. But, of course, if it becomes only a story, I see a deep problem. And even more so as this scriptural authority is really questioned. When the focus or the basis for the authority is not the Bible, God's word itself, but the story of the Bible as dwelling in the church. It's the church who carries this, and it's part of the church, and so on. How do you judge? How can you find criteria? I think this is really problematic. But the third issue is where I'd like us to focus. He says the main issue is epistemology, and we can start from that. What is good, when he is presenting his epistemology, he's not just inside the Bible or inside theology, but he interacts with sociology of knowledge, like Peter Berger, Alistair McIntyre, and these people, and also with Polanyi, philosophy of science. And that, I think, is a very good thing for us to do, to interact with the different areas of knowledge. of course, the weakness of Enlightenment projects and search for indubitable knowledge, I think that is really significant, a good point. challenging the fact-value distinction and this public-private division, which we are captive to, is certainly significant, important for us. And perhaps this view of personal knowledge as well is a very helpful way of understanding science, at least. A question comes if this tacit knowledge he's talking about, can we draw a line from tacit knowledge, which is knowledge which we haven't put into words, but which is important to give us, important for us as tools. Is that the same as faith? Because that's the link he does. The tacit knowledge of Polanyi is linked directly to what he understands as faith. And I have a question about that. I think we need to make other distinctions theologically than just this scientific, from the scientific perspective. In terms of a critique, which is the really funny part of criticizing, taking people down, being a Viking, that's, of course, our hobby. No, he is a very significant person, and I've heard lots of people who know him and admire him very much because he, as a person, as a teacher, as a Christian, he was a very fine person. So I want to point out that. But we still need to do a critique of his ideas, and that's what we're doing. The first point is that he seems to have a dual discourse. He's talking in two directions. And that's pointed out excellently in this book, A Scandalous Prophet, written by several authors after New Begin's death, in honor of him. Mm-hmm. Very much of it kind of admires him, but it gives it criticism as well. And the article by Thomas Faust is that he is engaging in a dual discourse. Two conversations going at the same time. And that's why that's his way of evading some challenges, because he's arguing from below. He's starting from Polanyi, from Peter Berger, saying that knowledge is relative, right? Knowledge is depending on your perspective. Knowledge is personal. If he had been kind of consistent, he would end up in relativism. But the reason why he's not ending up in relativism is that he has another discourse going on from above, starting from the Bible, saying that the Bible, New Begin, which said the gospel story, of course. We say the Bible, but he said the gospel story is the truth. It has happened. It's the truth about God. It's the truth about man and humanity. It is the true story. And he has that from the Bible. He is a theologian. So that's his starting point, that this is true. So in his discussion, he can jump from the one conversation or discourse to the other one. And when he's accused of relativism, he's jumping up saying, no, it's not relativism, because it's the true story. So that's an internal tension in his thinking. I don't know Barth all that well, but I feel there is a connection to Barth's way of thinking, that God's revelation comes directly from above, kind of changing everything. There's no connection from below to the Word of God.
How did he say he knew it was a true story?
Well, you cannot. He says that you start to read the story, and the story confronts you, right, with some strange and new claims. And then he says that you will decide, will I continue to read, will I accept it, or will I throw it away?
Yeah, isn't that consistent with this coming from below? It's still personal knowledge. His personal perspective is that it's a true story. I see a way in which the two could be combined in this thinking.
Yeah. Yes, it's the true story, but you cannot show, or you cannot from below point out that this is the true story. It's just from the inside.
You say it's my faith perspective that it's a true story.
Yes, but you still think it is the objectively the true story.
I'm asking, what reason did he give for that? And how did he defend that?
Basically, he doesn't really defend it. He says that this is the perspective of the story. And you cannot find any more ultimate reasons, justifications than the story itself. Yeah? Self-authenticating. He can point out several things that, well, the way you present, you proclaim the story, and when people accept it, they will see the change it makes in their lives and so on. But he says it would conflict with his view of the Bible and of God to say that there are some criteria that makes this truer than the others, because the criteria goes with the story, right? You have to be inside the story, because everything that was from the old perspective is gone. So he can say it's true. He even says it has intent. Its intent is universal, but you cannot show that.
He doesn't argue against its historicity.
No, he says, but he says you. He really says, well, these are facts that Jesus rose from the dead, but the point of the story is that God rose him from the dead, and by that turned the story, the path of history was changed at that point. And that's an interpretation. You can't find that. You can't even find God in the fact of the empty grave. That's an assumption, right? So the interpretation, the fact can be there, but the problem is that everything hinges on the story, which is the point here. The story of how God sent his Son, who he died for our sins, and was rose again by mighty hand of God, offering new life, the new community, a new future, and so on. Yes? Yeah?
Plausibility implies reasonableness, right? The word plausible.
Yeah.
Something's believable, something's reasonable.
Yeah.
So it's a plausibility structure. There's reasons for it to be true, to make sense.
Yeah.
Within the structure,
yeah.
So I think it'd be sort of like we all have our own story. I tell you who my father is, mm-hmm. who my kids are, and so forth, and nobody's going to ask me for a birth certificate to prove any of that. And I think for Newman, there's this long continuity, the church, and we're part of that story. We don't have good reason to doubt that story. Mm-hmm. It's a plausible story. Mm-hmm. Let somebody else question it, but let them first try it. I don't know. There's this ambiguity. Mm-hmm. It's like trying. You might say too much one way or too much the other. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to...
One of the important points of him is you shouldn't go outside the story. You have to use the criteria inside of every story.
You actually never exist outside the story. You're only inside.
Yeah.
The existence is only inside.
Only inside. You're never without the story. So his critique of liberal theology is that they have a different possibility. It's a different religion, basically, right? Different idea of who God is, or whether there is a God, if God can act in history, right? So it says we need to change the plausibility structure and see read the Bible from inside the story.
Mm-hmm. Do put it into connection, then what's the plausible structure of the story, and how to understand it without mm-hmm. without context?
It seems like he has a problem there, because the Christian should go into the story and read himself into the story. It's a dialogue with the story, because you need for this story you need both to know the center and the whole of the story at the same time, right? It's a dialogue between Jesus at the center and the whole creation and consummation all together. You need to understand all of them to understand one piece, and one to understand the center to understand the rest of it.
Similar to maybe Blaise Bonhoeffer, who is saying that it doesn't work in this way, that you will come to somebody mm-hmm. with this approach that you don't believe in God mm-hmm. and you are not afraid because of him, mm-hmm. then it simply doesn't work, because mm-hmm. you are touching somebody who is not in this
yeah.
story.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to proclaim somehow without reasoning.
Yeah, but if he says that, well, if I take his position, he says, I'm not stating some truths to you, but I'm telling you a story, and the story has a way
power
of
as such.
Huh?
As such. The story has power.
Yeah, in itself. Yeah.
Yeah, that's Barton. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Lindbeck and several other people. Mm-hmm. So, the gospel story, looking through it or at it, and of course we need to ask the question if whether or not it's essential, whether it's historical or factual, history. What does the Bible itself say about its factuality? What if we have this is a story which is internally consistent, has its own meaning. But we have, at some point, if we think it's significant, to ask, what does the story refer to? Like the resurrection. Does the story itself say that this historicity of the resurrection is significant? And it does, certainly. The story refers to secular story, to real story, history. And if that is the case, secular history has importance. It cannot be just the story. It has to be related to historical fact as well, since the Christian faith is historical, not just the story, but historical in its very essence. If we think of the incarnation, right? It's not just a story of God coming, but it is the true God taking on human flesh. And then this flesh and this flesh is significant, not just the story of it. That's one issue. But for apologetics, I think the faith versus rationality issue is maybe the central one. And he stays with, we have to believe first, then you get the reason. Mm-hmm. Start with faith, and then faith gives a meaning to the universe, gives meaning to the world. And he links to Augustine, but it is pointed out several places, special perhaps in this book, that he is not using Augustine the right way, Alistair MacIntyre neither. It was not Augustine's view that you have to believe faith in every sense goes before reason. He has a lot more balanced view of the relationship between reason and faith than this kind of pure fideism.
Augustine does.
And Newbegin has taken over Alistair MacIntyre's version of Augustine, it seems. Right? So, and Augustine had a lot more nuances and seeing this relationship in a more advanced and balanced way than he does. And of course we need to determine what is really faith. And he links to this tacit knowledge of science, and he's talking about plausibility structure, seeing the whole story and so on. And I think maybe these distinctions from the Reformation, that there are three kinds of faith. The first is fides historica, which is just knowledge. Let's say the resurrection. The devil knows that Jesus has risen, and he is shaking, right? He knows it's happened, but he's not a Christian in the proper sense, is he? The second one is someone who says, is this going to from fides historica to assensus, assent, right? In English, would it be? You agree. Well, Jesus rose from the dead, and I'm even happy for it. It's good, and it's really good. But that's in Luther's understanding, and he has a history of course himself, is that faith is nothing of these. Faith, the saving faith, is not seeing that Jesus has risen and oh, that's wonderful and you're a Christian. But saving faith is trust in a person, right? And if New Begin is linking faith basically to a perspective, an understanding, he's not coming to the essence of saving faith, perhaps. And if we keep these distinctions, maybe they are not so threatening to one another anyway, because you can see the resurrection and not becoming a Christian. You can resist Jesus Christ as a person, of course, because he comes as a person inviting us into his fellowship. And even if you know he is the truth, you can say no. So having proven that Jesus is the Lord doesn't save anyone, because faith is linking and saying yes to him as our groom, bridegroom, or yeah.
So do you mean that the saving faith is fiducia?
Yes. That's
without
that,
the first two?
No, not without them, but it's more basic. You need to know that Jesus has lived and has risen, and that can give you a basis for trusting him, right?
You mean that
they build.
Stops before fiducia.
Yes, it seems to be, but he still has a room for it. No, that's not correct. But the way he uses faith seems to be, you need faith before you can understand. You don't need to trust Jesus before you can understand, but you need a worldview, which is knowledge. Yeah, you need to accept the Christian worldview to understand the universe. But the Christian worldview... Yeah. But the personal trust for New Begin is very essential as well. But this is not the point he brings it in. He talks very much about Buber, I, thou. And that's very significant in some places. But when he builds up his argument, he seems to stop with faith as presuppositions. The mental framework you need to understand the rest. The mental framework for reason and so on. And I question that as a good connection. Yeah.
You are just responding to what's happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't start with faith. Faith is reaction. It starts with revelation.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's one way of saying it. But he's going into the mind of the person, not starting from the outside. Well, God has acted. He's given us a story. But from inside of me, God doesn't give me kind of external reasons to trust him. He talks to me, and from that experience can create trust in him. And the point B, experientially, what about people's experience of coming to faith? I think lots of people have come to faith by using reason. Like C.S. Lewis, he was disillusioned with atheism, going to monotheism, right? And then coming to faith in Christ. That's was his reason was pushing him towards faith. But faith, the final point of faith is, of course, confidence or trust in the person of Jesus Christ and in God. But reason has an important place for a lot of people. And for many of us, it has been important for coming to faith. Myself, I've grown up in a Christian family, so I can't say that was the reason was what pushed me to faith. But reason has been a very important thing, which has kept me in my place and given new confidence, of course. But experientially, we can see that people are moved to faith by using reason. And I think that's an important reflection to make. So it's not like faith. People have to believe first, and then the reason comes afterward. That can happen. But the other way around is also possible. And then some ontologically, I think we can't say that everything is relative to your perspective. I think as Christians, we must think that the universe has a certain form and shape, and God is really there. And God has created the universe in a special way, and the universe has a story. Gravity isn't relative to your perspective, right? You clash and you make a lot of mess if you jump from the ceiling. No, ceiling, roof, right? You jump from a roof in English. Sorry. So there are things ontologically, objective realities. And one of them, of course, is creation, man created in God's image, and the fall and so on. And we need to take that into perspective when we talk to people. That explains how they react and how they reason, what are their true nature. Epistemologically, he would say there cannot be objective criteria. Well, I think we can say, just like in ethics, ethics aren't completely relative. There are very, very much structures and like the Ten Commandments. You find version of them in every culture. You can't live without them. I think there's a parallel also in epistemology. There are ways of thinking you cannot avoid, like the principle of coherence. In some sense, of course, the way you understand coherence will depend on your culture as well. And correspondence, you always imply that your words refer to something, and also the pragmatic tests. And maybe the third one, or the point E here, biblically, where is the biblical justification and models? He is using very little Bible to explain his position. He's using very much sociology and philosophy of science, and seeing how he's using Acts 26 as his model for conversion. That's Paul's conversion. And that's, no one of us have probably been converted that way. It's such a unique conversion. And he uses that as a model for how God deals with us. And it's very interesting. If you read Acts 26, Paul's confronting Agrippa, right? And it's not just he's telling his story of conversion. But after that, he's arguing with him. These things didn't happen in a corner. That's the correspondence test, right? These things happened historically, and that is significant for us as apologists. And I'm not mad. I've been thinking through these things. That's kind of the coherence aspect, right? And when he responds that that you almost convinced me now, but not quite. And that could be the way the gospel can change and transform a person. Of course, Agrippa keeps this some inches away from himself. Yes. Conclusion. The West as a mission field, I think that's really significant, because we need to examine our culture, and we need to also to understand that our culture is influencing all the rest of the world. And if we imbibe our culture uncritically, we're going to damage also the rest of the world. We need to be critical about it. And of course, the importance of apologetics. where I think Phidyism, which I think he falls into, although he tries very hard to get out of the accusation, is not an option for us today. We cannot say it's just a story, it's just my perspective. The Bible doesn't seem to say so. Philosophy doesn't seem to say so. Reality doesn't seem to say so. And an experience in mission and evangelism doesn't seem to work that way. Yeah. Okay. That's my... I think maybe I'll read the comment here from Tim Stafford, writing for Christianity Today several years ago, while he was still, Leslie Newbegin was still alive. If one is looking at the total situation of Christianity in the contemporary world, addressing European culture is the most urgent question, Leslie Newbegin says. First, it's modern post-Enlightenment Western culture that in the guise of modernization is replacing more traditional cultures all over the world. And second, because this culture has a unique power to erode and neutralize the Christian faith. So that's why the Western culture is a special challenge, and he really did a good attempt at coming to grips with it. But we need a different approach from Newbegin. At least I self want to suggest that. Yeah?
I would just like to ask whether you suggest then that we as Christians do not operate within a sort of hermeneutical circle. In other words, we do not have a certain pre-understanding of what's reality. And I mean, in epistemology, all these people like Berger and Lani and others would basically say just we do not have a direct access, an unmediated access to objective reality. And just about everybody I've found at least would say, well, there is a grid of perception which we have taken from our culture, our and everything, and therefore our perception of reality is to some extent shaped by all these influences, especially if we are part of such a such a powerful tradition as the Christian tradition.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, can we really establish easily a common platform with people who operate from within different symbolic universes or different language games? Certainly there is a possibility of interaction. Even Lindbeck would say that there are places of overlap, and he would not be completely against apologetics. He speaks about what he calls ad hoc apologetics, that there are topics and overlaps which can be a meeting point between these two bubbles or these two symbolic universes. But would you then think that we are not influenced in this sense? In other words, do we not need this story as a referential point? Or is there can we actually step outside of our shoes, our Christian shoes?
Or our minds.
Can we pretend to be not yet Christians to find a point of contact with them?
I don't know about being Newbegin or
both.
In one sense, to some extent, challenging your critique of
Newbegin. Yeah.
Because I think there is a point in what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
And there is a point in what Barth and other
states,
Reformed theologians would say.
Yeah. I think it's very important to realize how your presuppositions shape your understanding and culture. I think that's very significant, and that's important to work with. But I think, try this. I haven't arrived at the final truth yet. I'm waiting for it, of course. But as a Christian, I assume objective reality, that human beings are made in God's image, they are fallen, and that gives me some tools to understand them, to predict what some things about their way of behaving and so on. So that is, in that sense, I think it's objective reality, and we need to, that's a kind of also Schaeffer's kind of starting point. But the other thing, in terms of ontology, things in one sense as Christians, we need to think this is ultimate reality. However, I find it very important and helpful for us that we use maybe not the plausibility structures kind of language, but at least worldview perspectives and see how our worldviews are formed and what they contain. And then we can try to, it is possible to examine different worldviews, naturalism, but very often the worldviews we examine are very similar to our own. Naturalism and humanism, they belong kind of a little bit to in the same culture. But even Schaeffer, you would know him, I guess, he would discuss Hinduism or Buddhist presuppositions and worldviews and discussing and reasoning, finding points of contact from the basis of reality or true truth or the ways he said this. So I would say yes and no. Our worldview shape our understanding also of reason and these things. And we need to be aware of it.
But don't you justify the fact that there is a common platform? At least I do. I believe there is a common platform. Rationally, ethically speaking. But I do justify that by the doctrine of creation. So it is an inner systemic justification. I have to be a Christian. I have to have the Genesis 1 argument in order to be able to establish objectivity, the world out there, and a common platform, because all people, I believe, because I'm a Christian, are created in God's image, and therefore there is something in common, because their rationality reflects God's rationality in one sense. So I need an inner systemic explanation and justification for this presupposition. I cannot pretend, because without Genesis 1, I would have no reason for establishing a common. So I am within my bubble. I am inside of my symbolic universe. Inside of the story. I need a story even to justify the common platform with those outside of the story, I think.
Yes, we need not just the reality of the external universe and so on, but we need the story of the fall, which is not available to us examining it now, right? So I agree, we need an explanation for it. In some sense, you have more comments. It's a time, okay. Saved. But no, I think we need to discuss this further on, but I feel that the position of New Begin is not sufficiently grounded. And I think kind of this perspective of worldviews showing the relativity of knowledge, but there are still ways of connecting. You can use reason, and you can go into a system and check the internal consistency. You can check some of the pragmatic, how it changes and transforms people, and so on. And that is something which is important. It's not like reality is totally relative. So that's, yeah.
Himself is not fully consistent, which makes it hard to critique. And one of the things I appreciate is his resurfacing of the power of the story as it But in affirming its power, he does that as though he has a kind of objective raster with which to define which things are powerful and which things are less powerful. But his affirmation of the power of the story is one which presupposes so much about the world that de facto. He comes out quite close in terms of a view of objectivity as the truth, and the power of the story. In his practice, I think we resonate more with him than in some of the logical conclusions of his journey through tacit knowledge, especially. I agree that it gets easier. When you push him only on his theoretical claims, but in practice, I have an appreciation for his affirmation of the power of the story, which in a sense, he gives us permission to proclaim with confidence that power
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But isn't that the same as with God, really? That God has, he has a great charismatic strength, a strength in terms of the proclamation and preaching. But he's, like New Guinea, has a very weak, as Jonas pointed out for us, a very weak epistemological basis. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so the thing is that he's not completely consistent with this weak epistemological basis.
No, he's strong. He says he has a strong God.
Yeah, so that's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had your arm.
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think he was critiquing it again, but I think he addressed the problem when he put the Western situation as a tension of plausibility structures. You know, how we in the West approach science, or how we show epistemological preference for empirical science or deductive science, and revelation has no place in it. I mean, a sort of, if he talks about becoming a Christian, God exploding in your life.
Mm-hmm.
That's a revelation. And that, those are two things that cannot, that cannot meet.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he does a good job in just in dissecting the Western situation.
Mm-hmm.
And when Pavel was talking about trying to find common ground, I think the only common ground is the cross. Because the cross is an event that's outside space and time. And Jesus is all revelation.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, as the cross breaks into the Western or whatever political structure, it becomes all history. It becomes history rather than just a story. It becomes history, which is all knowledge. So within the cross is the union.
Yep.
And can you see, but without the cross, there's no way, there's no common ground between the two.
I would say there are more. The cross would be kind of more confrontation with everything that's there before. But of course, it can build on suffering and search for meaning and so on. But I do think there is something in terms of rationality, search for meaning, many points of contact in many kind of ideas, in Hinduism, pantheism, in naturalism, all these things. It's not just the cross. There are many elements which are common, which we can build on. The view of humanity, right? Search or longing for meaning and purpose and value and so on. Not just the cross, but that would be, of course, the aim if you want to turn. Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. But I mean, we should look for a lot more common ground than we do. Even like it did this morning, looking at movies and so finding positive things under it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry.
There is some significant changes as a result of less community values in Christian environment. I mean, are there some already, or could we expect some?
In the churches or
yeah, maybe Christian environment. How much do you think it influences certain kind of groups?
I would just say that I'm not sure, but you have this movement, Gospel and Culture, which still is Gospel and Our Culture. Yeah, sorry. Which is significant and very, very important, and I think it can give a new courage to proclaim the gospel and also to be involved in different areas of the culture, seeing the culture as a calling. So I think that can be a very significant. But I haven't studied him that much that I can say that this is the consequences and so on. Mm-hmm.
Would it be possible to say what you said towards the end of your minute, that the West as a mission field has been
neglected.
It has been, it's not the only one saying, but it's certainly the most important one saying this. So that is a very crucial thing for us, since many of the traditional evangelical missionary societies, for example, tend to look beyond Europe all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Don't consider Europe itself as it's a very important issue.
Because it looks like quite a revolutionary theory, So I was just curious whether. I mean, whether you, I mean, it is studying in Northern Ivy seek some kind of influence or possible influence, mm-hmm. possible kind of help within the Christian, mm-hmm. Christian environment.
It's very widely quoted.
Hmm?
It's very widely quoted.
Yes, very many people read him. So.
But.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a comment or question?
No, I just wanted to say, according to Mabel,
mm-hmm.
according to common ground, that if we can find common ground only in our story because of creation of the that image, I would say. You can see also in other stories, in Hinduism, in other religions, because the human being is target of revelation in also in other stories, not just in our story. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is our common ground, that we are target of revelation.
Mm-hmm.
This is
according to this subject, the possibility of translation of stories
mm-hmm.
is an argument for
okay, a language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There can be some common rationality in one sense. And like yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Common not only the possibility of translation, only a linguistic argument.
Yeah.
But this is exactly what George Hendrick would actually strongly disagree with. He would say that the story has its inner grammar and that he is using this language. Religions, for example, that they are languages, and that you basically cannot, when you have Chinese and when you have Turkish language, you cannot learn Chinese from translation from Chinese into Turkish. You only have to immerse yourself into the Chinese environment to learn the language, to socialize yourself in the Chinese environment. Because as long as the Turkish people keep translating everything for you from Chinese to Turkish, you never basically touch the very language you want to teach. So translatability is actually being used by narrative theologians of linguistics on which Newbegin draws as a very argument against the possibility to translate one single universe into mm-hmm. the other. He said these are compact, consistent, coherent mm-hmm. goals, and you basically cannot translate one into the other.
That, what language Lindbeck write in?
English.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think I think we need to relativize these relativizers. I think that's one of the plausibility structures. Everything is relative, but okay, but that's relative to their plausibility structures, like absolute relativism. That's self-defeating. I think there is some way we need to relativize these kind of attempts to be absolute. But I think there is a point that in many stories you will lose a point, and you would lead. That's why we need to learn Hebrew and Greek. But it seems that people can even come to faith from the Norwegian Bible, although they become very strange Christians. Norwegian, right? Right? Because we don't hand them the Greek and Hebrew. So
following on from that, I think there's because I think there is a real challenge to understand how to encounter this kind of objection.
Mm-hmm.
And as Björn pointed out, ontology I think is an important thing. That even though we come to know something, I mean that's the epistemological bit,
mm-hmm.
through our worldview and so on. The difference between coming to know something
mm-hmm.
So even though we come to know that something through our worldview, I mean through our story, it doesn't mean that that story doesn't correspond to reality. But that we actually experience reality through experiencing our story.
And that's exactly what Newbegin is saying. I think he said, well, I'm within my story, but I strongly believe that this story corresponds to objective reality. That's the double discourse.
Yeah, but that's emphasized. Then says that there is no way of checking whether that story is true or not outside the story, or with reference to extra textual things as we have. And that really doesn't fit with.
with experience and development.
I'm wondering, then the assertion that religion is language is one which is not beyond criticism. It's it is one which is also being criticized by the faith. And this is one that's talking about relativizers. This is one of us.
Yes, okay. Thank you very much for your patience.